Now, the very fantastic and award-winning and best-selling writer and journalist and documentary filmmaker John Ronson is coming back to Ireland in May with his new show called Tales from the Last Days of August and The Butterfly Effect, including dates in Dublin's Vicar Street and Cork's Opera House. In this brand new show, he's going to recount his recent adventures in the porn world based on his hit podcasts The Butterfly Effect and The Last Days of August. It's going to be a mysterious, funny, it says here, sad tale about porn, kindness, violence, bad thoughts and the wonders of remaining curious. New stories never before heard, audio and lots more besides. And as you know, probably John Ronson's non-fiction books include So You've Been Publicly Shamed, The Psychopath Test, Them, Adventures with Extremists, Lost at Sea and The Men Who Stare at Goats. All have been international and are New York Times bestsellers, translated into more than 30 languages, and his two TED Talks have been watched 15 million times. So I want to welcome him now to the programme. Welcome to the programme, John. John, you have written about public shaming. You spent a lot of time in the porn world. And do you think that this one here now, The Last Days of August, do you think that this one falls into both categories?
Well, the story turned into a very different story to what I imagined it would. Because I thought when I got involved in this story that it was going to be a story about a woman who died because she was Twitter bullied. But then as soon as I started talking to the people who had bullied her on Twitter, they started saying these kind of very mysterious coded things to me about other things in her life that may have contributed to her death. And of course, part of me thought, well, are they just trying to pass the buck? But then another part of me thought, wow, they're saying some very oblique, mysterious things to me, and I better keep going on this story.
So are you saying like that there would have been inconsistencies and contradictions and mysteries and that nothing is ever as straightforward as it seems?
Yes. And you know what? I think that's something that we should think about whenever we've got the inclination to destroy somebody's life on Twitter, which is that that person quite often has other stuff going on in their lives. They are more than just the sum of that one offensive tweet, and it's irrational and wrong to just assume we know everything about that person just from a tiny little slither of their lives. And we do this every day. You know, we destroy somebody, we get them fired, and then a couple of days later it turns out that there was more to the story than we thought, or that person was struggling with mental health issues or something. But you know, the problem with Twitter is that it reduces everything to a little, everyone's a Miss Marple, you know. I mean, this was happening before Twitter. I remember the whole chemtrails thing. People would like look up at the sky and see those trails and just, you know, decide that was like, you know, the tip of a huge iceberg. Everyone wants to be Miss Marple, but on Twitter we have that power and it ends in tragedy.
Well, then let's go back from tragedy for the moment, I'll come back to The Last Days of August later. But like with So You've Been Publicly Shamed and what you're talking about just there, and if you do take one or two examples, and Justine Sacco was an example who had 170 followers, and I remember it so well, like 170 is, I suppose, in the scheme of things, not very much. And she texts getting on a plane, weird German dude, get some deodorant. And then she also texted, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. 11 hours later, she wakes up and she is the biggest single trending thing in the world on Twitter. If she was mocking US ignorance of South Africa, and she is American, and, you know, which is what she says, is it just that it's very easy and even quite thrilling to actually hate a stranger online?
Yeah, and in that case, a stranger who was asleep on a plane and completely oblivious to her destruction. We had, and when I say we, I mean, kind of everyone. This was a shaming that everybody could get behind.
Yeah.
Misogynists hated her. Woke people hated her. Donald Trump hated her. He got involved that night. And what was hilarious to the world was that we were putting her on trial, sentencing her, and before she even knew that anything was happening, she was asleep on a plane. There was no Wi-Fi on the plane. She was completely oblivious to her destruction. And while what you should think is what an injudicial, monstrous thing to do to somebody, especially because the joke was intended to be a liberal joke mocking privilege as opposed to a racist joke, instead of thinking, whoa, we messed up there, we thought, it was hilarious. The world thought it was hilarious that we were destroying somebody who didn't know she was being destroyed.
Well, okay, then what about the fact that we are kind of powerless to stop that? I think it was a doctor or a dentist or something who goes to Africa, whatever, and shoots elephants and shoots lions and puts big pictures of himself. And the only way people can get back at it is by, if you like, public shaming. And frankly, I'm not against that one.
Sure. Sorry. Well, you know, there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of shamings I'm not against, and many shamings have led to what feel like real improvements in the culture. Yeah. One that just leapt into my mind as I said that was the Oscars So White controversy. Do you remember?
I do.
About 3 years ago, there was a photograph of all the Oscar contenders, and I think one of them was a person of colour. This huge sea of white faces. So sure, there's an awful lot of shamings that are great. There's also a lot of shamings that are morally very complicated, based on false evidence. An awful lot. I mean, Twitter is the world's worst information swapping service. I mean, how many times do we get repulsed by somebody and then a couple of days later we realise we got the story entirely wrong? Yeah. I'll give you one example of that. A woman, I don't know if you remember this one, for 2 days she was the world's worst human, but then of course we just move on and forget and don't even think about whether they're okay or not. This was a woman whose orphaned nephew, tiny little boy, lost both of his parents, saw his aunt, jumped into her arms, she broke her wrist, and he sued him. So that sounds like the worst story ever, right? And you can completely imagine why everybody hated this woman. But then a couple of days later, it turns out that the story was completely wrong. And it was because of this terrible healthcare system that they have in America. You have to use certain words to get certain insurances and so on. So the use of words that were in her insurance form led some local reporter to wrongly think that she was suing her orphaned 10-year-old nephew. And you know what, Dave? Did the world in that situation think, whoa, we've learnt an important lesson about waiting 48 hours before deciding to destroy somebody? No, the world did not learn that lesson. What the world did was just never talk about it again and move on.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the terrible kind of untrue story on page one for a week, and then the apology comes later on page 99. It's the same kind of thing.
We had the chance of doing things better. We had the chance of doing journalism better. And I remember somebody said to me at one point, you know, on Twitter, we all claim to hate tabloids, yet we all act like tabloids.
Oh, absolutely. Now, let's take a look then. Let's go back to what you're talking about and take that with us from the So You've Been Publicly Shamed to the last days of August. I mean, as I said earlier on, like the whole thing, nothing is ever as straightforward as it seems. At the start of the second episode, I'm going to just quote what you say. You say, I don't want this to be one of those shows that create narrative tension by fueling suspicion that the person might be a murderer. So I want to tell you that while we uncover some extraordinary, unexpected things and devastating mysteries will reveal themselves and be solved, this will not turn out to be a murder mystery. You're not trying to make it like the podcast Serial. You're not trying to make it, How to Be a Murderer or whatever that one was called, or the murderer one.
I'm glad I've never listened to How to Be a Murderer.
Give you some bad tips
on how to be a murderer.
Not How to Be a Murderer, but you know the one that's in
Maryland, I know what you mean. Making a murderer.
Sorry, How to Be a Murderer. God almighty, I don't need you. Hold on, shut up. I'm not there yet. Anyway, like, it's not like Serial where at the end of like 5, 6 and 7 I go, oh, I wonder could he be guilty or not. And the end of number 12, the last one, I'm still going, God, I wonder could he be guilty or not. It's not that kind of thing. It's not a Mrs. Marple thing at all. How do you tell the story of a person's life? And what do you want to do with this? Because there's an awful lot of different things that happen there. I mean, you were up in some 11th floor of a hotel in Vegas doing something with Jessica Drake. There was a guy called, or somebody called Jaxton Wheeler, a porn star. She showed you, or sorry, didn't she say that the girl August should take a cyanide pill? How do you work it all out?
Well, this was a very strange and uncomfortable story to find myself in the middle of. I thought, as I said before, it would be just a social media shaming story.
Yeah.
And I had this very modest idea for the story. I would bring August to life in a very sort of humanistic and empathetic way. And then I had this idea of doing the same thing to the people who tore her apart. What was happening in their lives that led them to tweet, the world is awaiting your apology or for you to swallow a cyanide pill, which was something that somebody tweeted to her. what was happening in their lives too. So I had that kind of quite modest ambition. And then, as you say, I suddenly start to get clues that her life and death may be different to the official story. And the official story was being promoted by her husband, Kevin, who was saying, she's dead because of that person. She's dead because of that person. He was pointing the finger at the Twitter bullying. It was incredibly hard. It's that, you know, I've been doing this for 32 years now, and I would say it's probably the hardest story I've ever had to do, because you are dealing with an unthinkable tragedy, the death of a 23-year-old, a lovely, delightful 23-year-old. And, I mean, to cut to the chase, the fact is there was a bunch of people around her who let her down. But those people are now grieving. So now that I'd stumbled into that story, what do I do with that? And it was very hard.
So did you want to bring August to life, a woman who took her own life in a public park? Did you want to literally kind of bring her, put her out there, and then concentrate on the shamers and what was happening in their lives?
At the very beginning of the story, yes, that was my idea. I would just write these kind of humanist character portraits of both August and the people who, according to her husband, contributed to her suicide, or more than contributed.
Well, then, to make it a bit serial or True Detective or whatever, is it a question of clues all adding up?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I've never said this out loud before, so Dave, tell me if you think this is nonsense. I think people are quite blithe about the death of other people often. It's like, oh, that person killed themselves, or, oh, that person's dead. And you feel, you know, sort of a little sad for a little while, and then you kind of move on. And I think as a writer, as somebody who wants to understand the way the world works and the way that people work and the way that we behave towards each other, you know, in an empathetic and compassionate way. For me, the death of a 23-year-old isn't something that you feel sad about for a few minutes and then forget about it and move on and think, well, it's no big deal, people die all the time. I think the death of a 23-year-old is an unthinkably huge thing to happen. And I think that's what was motivating me in this story. It's like, it's, you know, this woman who had everything to live for. Everybody loved her. She was delightful. In the porn world, she was really successful. And she was just kind of charming. And I just wanted to, God, I've been living in America too long, because the word that's about to come into my head is honour. I wanted to just sort of honour her life, you know. Yeah, I think that's what was guiding me.
Okay, by the way, we are talking to John Ronson. John, the Butterfly Effect was a 7-series thing, like kind of internet porn changing the film industry, and then a kind of a fascinating examination of an industry in turmoil and basically how the internet changed porn as well. So yeah. Do you think in some ways that, you know, The Last Days here of August is a sequel to Butterfly Effect?
Yeah, The Butterfly Effect was a very positive, upbeat story about porn people supporting each other in this, you know, very sweet-natured way, while these outside tech gurus kind of destroy, you know, decimate their industry. And of course, you know, it's about porn, but it could easily be about taxis or music or journalism, so many things. But it's a very upbeat story about porn people just being very nice and sweet. And then when August died, a few months after we finished making The Butterfly Effect, that's a very different story. That's a story about a very dysfunctional porn world full of people with mental health issues who want to help each other but are incapable of doing it, because everybody's full of, you know, like all of us, you know, full of our own baggage and difficulties and so on. So yeah, it's a sequel, but tonally it's very different.
Yeah, I get you. But I mean, like, August was bisexual, and we're talking homophobia and cyberbullying and sexual abuse and mental health and complicated gender kind of relations as well. Do you think in some ways that right across the whole board of all of this, that you're looking at and involving yourself in a world defined by men?
You know, The Last Days of August is, I think, to a large extent, a story about gender, about why some men behave poorly towards some women. I say some men because I get really annoyed when people talk about kind of men, because, you know, there's lots of men who don't behave poorly towards women, but some men definitely do. That, you know, that term toxic masculinity, even though I slightly bristle at it sometimes, it's real. It's a real thing. It's true. And in the last days of August, we certainly discovered a bunch of men who would treat women badly and then trick themselves using kind of various psychological tricks into thinking that they hadn't done that.
So
I think it is a thing about gender. Would add that there's some men in the last days of August who are delightful. I mean, August's brother James is a very lovely man. And then there's some women in the last days of August who are a little bit mean-spirited. I'm very reluctant to do stories where all the men are bad and all the women are good, because again, that's just not true about humans.
Sure. And by the way, you'll be bringing this conversation, and I presume questions and answers from an audience, Tales from the Last Days of August and the Butterfly Effect with John Ronson, in Dublin here at Vicar Street on the 29th of May, and in Cork at the Opera House on the 30th of May. Just to go into some other things that you did and didn't do. In fact, I'll go to something you didn't do. Let's go to 13 years ago, the credit card story. You spent 6 months on the damn thing and you threw it in the bin. I mean, like, you know, it's all about the secret tricks that they use to get us into debt, etc. And it was ripe for the kind of John Ronson investigation I would have expected. But one of the things you said was, no, the people were boring. I mean, if the people were boring, is the subject itself not fascinating enough to carry it through to the end?
Yeah, you're right. I failed. It was a failing. I would like to think that if I was embarking on it now with 13 years extra writing maturity, I'd be able to do it better. But back then, you're right. I'd just written The Men Who Stare at Goats. I hadn't written The Psychopath Test by then.
Yeah.
I'd just written The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was full of these kind of extraordinary, crazy lieutenant colonels who thought that they could
with great
kill
names,
goats.
As well as everything else.
General Stubblebine, who was the head of army intelligence. He had tens of thousands of soldiers under his command, and secretly in his office, he would try and walk through his wall.
Yeah.
So he'd jog and then bump his nose. So I just spent a couple of years with these amazing people, and then I wanted to kind of do a Men Who Stare at Goats of the credit card industry, and it turns out that no heads of credit card companies try and kill goats just by staring at them.
Ah, damn. Yeah.
And I just felt, you know, I just couldn't do it. I was
but
in the
just
wrong
think of what you,
mature place.
Right. You might have been in the wrong mature... Okay, hold on a second. You were in the right time, though. Because if you had kept going, you would have been the oracle. You would have told us about the crash before the crash happened, before 2008, and everybody would have said, you know, Ronson, the oracle, you know, how prescient, the wizard, Gandalf.
As my American publisher often reminds me, if you'd carried on that book, you'd have been, everyone would have thought you were a genius. Because you're right, the book would have come out just before the credit crunch.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, it was bad. But all I can tell you, you know, my memory of those 6 months trying to write that book was I'd go down to the kitchen in the morning, get myself some cereal, and I think to myself, it's only 10 hours till I can watch TV. And that's no way to live your life.
Don't know about that.
Well, these days, actually, as I get older, I think that more and more. Yeah. But, you know, that was a real warning sign that book... That book was making me kind of depressed.
Sure, but the prescience that I mentioned there, you did do that in terms of the publicly shamed one, because there was no Me Too and there was no Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, it's true. I think there's probably... You know, I think there's three occasions in my life where I luckily spotted something before other people did. And one was my book Them, with the rise of conspiracy theorists and the alt-right and so on. And that's back in like 1999. This was before anyone was talking about conspiracy theories and before anybody ever talked about Alex Jones or... I mean, when I say anybody, I mean the mainstream world. And then I feel I did the same thing with The Psychopath Test. I think I kind of preempted people's interest in psychopaths who rule the world and also the sort of vagaries and ambiguities in the mental health industry. And then I did it a third time with So You've Been Publicly Shamed. I sort of predicted before most people did that Twitter was actually this very malevolent force that was going to change the world.
Do you think
for the
with
worse.
The psychopath test there was a bit more than that? That it was actually a journey through the madness industry?
Yeah, it's a sort of ambiguous book because in the first half of the book, I learn how to spot psychopaths. And I sort of go on a course that teaches me how to spot psychopaths, and then I excitedly journey into the corridors of power trying to spot corporate psychopaths and political psychopaths and so on. But then the second half of the book kind of becomes a cautionary tale about how I got a little bit too drunk with my psychopath spotting skills and started spotting them everywhere. So the book is both. I think the book does quite a good thing. You know, it's equally fair about people who see a purpose in mental health labelling, and it's also very fair about people who think that mental health labelling can actually harm society.
And you mentioned them earlier on, which goes right back in terms of what you've written, Adventures with Extremists. David Icke, Ian Paisley, were they interesting, yeah, interesting subjects to, you know, delve into?
Yeah, I've got fondish memories of going to Cameroon with
Reverend
Paisley. Fondish.
I heard the ish.
Yeah, it's probably more ish than fond. He was a little bit of a bully back then. I mean, you know, by all accounts, he got better in his latter years. Mm. This was just before the Good Friday Agreement. And yeah, Reverend Paisley wanted to distance himself from the peace process. So he went to Cameroon to preach to the sinners and we followed him. And I mean, the respect came from him being an incredible orator. And I remember one night we were in this church in the middle of nowhere in this place called, I think it was called Yaoundé in Cameroon, and the lights weren't working, so he borrowed a little light from our cameraman David Barker and propped it on the floor and preached to the sinners, and his shadow was like Godzilla over, you know, like on the church behind him. And I remember to this day that what he said, you know, Christ stands before you with a nail-pierced hand. He's knocking to get in. Will you let him in? So as an orator, he was amazing. As a travelling companion, he was a bit of a nightmare.
There's so many people I'd like to talk to you about, like Robbie Williams and UFO and the paranormal. Yeah. I'd say that was fun. Or playing keyboards with Frank Sidebottom. I just want to know if you ever did it live. Did you ever play the song that he plays to Kylie Minogue? Did you? He's got a great song on his album called "Oh Kylie, 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 Oh Minogue, Minogue, Minogue." You've never heard that, have you? It's fantastic.
No,
it's brilliant.
We haven't, but we used to play. We used to cover "I Should Be So Lucky."
Oh yeah, well that was his big hit.
Yeah,
if I can call it that.
Listen, just call it big.
Just a couple of things, like, you know, when something's, I'm going to look at just Twitter and Instagram. I presume Instagram is much safer, and Twitter is just not to be used, kind of thing. Is that it, really?
I think so, yeah. I think of Instagram as a place to watch dog videos. Yeah. And I think of Twitter as a place where I can remind myself what it was like this time. I was actually with somebody from Dublin. I was with Dara Carville, the great Irish playwright. And we were in the countryside and we came across an electric fence and we spent ages deciding whether or not to touch it. And that's what it feels like being on Twitter.
Right.
You're standing at an electric fence and you don't know whether to touch
and
it.
And one of the reasons being that when something small happens, that's bad, and something monstrous happens, that's bad, we have a tendency to treat the two of them equally.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the big problems with Twitter is an inability to differentiate between serious and less serious transgressions.
Okay,
so Justine Sacco, the woman on the plane, was treated with the same level of ferocity as somebody who had done something way worse.
Well, John, thank you so much for talking to us on the programme today. We look forward to you coming to Dublin. It's Vicar Street on the 29th of May. It's the Cork Opera House on the 30th of May. And you'll specifically be talking about Tales from the Last Days of August and The Butterfly Effect. But then it could go anywhere.
I think it can go anywhere. I think that's going to be the base of it, but it could go anywhere.
Okay, Frank Sidebottom it is. Listen, John, thank you so much for talking to us, John. Good luck. Take it easy.
David, it's a pleasure. Thank you.